Imagine earning continuing education credits while doing exactly what you're doing right now. Well, you can. Gable Media has revolutionized the way you earn your continuing education credits with a groundbreaking approach. Forget running around town and scouring the internet for credit-worthy courses. Fulfill your CE requirements effortlessly by listening to engaging podcasts just like the one you're listening to now. Our podcasts are designed to educate, entertain, and inspire, all in a user-friendly environment. But wait, there's more. Architects, Gable Media is also approved as an AIA Continuing Education Services provider. Upon completion, we handle everything, from reporting your hours directly to the AIA to storing your certificates in your personal Gable Media profile for your self-reporting needs. So follow the link in the show notes and start earning your credits in the most innovative and entertaining way possible with Gable Media.
My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Today's episode is a special conversation in anticipation of the Taliesin experience. The live Entree Architect community event scheduled for June 8th, 2026 at Frank Lloyd Wright's Taliesin in Spring Green, Wisconsin. I'm joined by my collaborator, architect James Ray Polk, whose work explores the powerful relationship between architecture, music, and human emotion. With more than 40 years in experience, James has built a career around understanding how rhythm, harmony, and tone shape the way we experience space. Through his work at Music in Architecture, he reminds us that architecture is not just something we see, it's something we feel. His perspective offers a unique and deeply human way to experience Taliesin and the architecture of Frank Lloyd Wright. James Ray Polk, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Thank you, Mark. It's great to be here.
I love this. I love having you on the show. You and I have known each other forever. You're an active member at Entree Architect for many, many years. We've collaborated on and off for little things, but we are doing something big here.
Right.
And the Taliesin experience at Taliesin, I'm so excited about it. I'm so excited about the experience, this live event for our community. And that's, we're going to talk a little bit about that at the end. But this is a podcast about you, James. I want to know more about you. I want to know your origin story and how you got to where you are. So let's start there. When did you discover your passion for architecture, and who or what inspired you to get started?
Well, that's interesting. I grew up around music, not necessarily around architecture, but from the youngest I can remember, church choir. So singing in church, singing in school choirs, being in the band, played trombone, took piano lessons. That was a pretty rich part of my life as I was growing up as a child.
Were your parents musicians?
My mom sang. My dad was a fan of music, and my dad took us to gospel sing. See, I grew up in South Mississippi, and so Southern gospel is pretty... That genre is kind of ground zero for where I was. And there would be what would be a festival called festival today, but they were called gospel sings back then. And some of the big, more well-known groups would come through. And there was a good bit of musicality. They were making their own music. They weren't singing to tapes. They brought their instruments with them. And I was enamored by that. But the whole world of music in general, I thought I was going to be a band director, a composer, a symphony director. And then I took an architectural drawing class in high school, when I was a junior in high school. And the reason I took it was because art wasn't offered at my high school. They didn't have art in the curriculum, and I wanted to draw. I liked to draw. So I took a mechanical drawing course, and then as a freshman, then a couple of years later, I took the architectural drawing course. Our assistant principal was interested in that, so that was offered. And in our textbook, I saw Frank Lloyd Wright's Falling Water, Johnson Wax Building, and Price Tower. And I just remembered, I mean, it's almost like the sound of screeching tires when you put on the brakes. And I just stopped at that point and I just stared at the pages. I'd never seen anything like that before. It was like, these buildings weren't walls and roof. They had a soul. They were alive. And I said to myself, I want to do that. I really want to do that. So that kind of changed what I thought was my trajectory into architecture. And so I went to enrolled in Mississippi State School of Architecture. It was a young school, but had a great dean there. Cornell recruited our dean, Dean McMinn from Mississippi State. He had already been dean at LSU and Auburn, and he knew everybody that there was in architecture. He could get on the phone and talk to these folks and say, yeah, come down here to Mississippi. One of my great memories there, educational opportunities too, is we had a vertical studio for a week that we had Eisenman, Tigerman,
wow,
Charles Moore, Paul Kennan from CNN, Robert Stern, and who am I leaving out here? There was another equally as famous, six famous architects who came in to small school in South Mississippi and stayed a week, and we did a vertical studio. Mind-blowing.
Yeah.
That sort of opened me up to the world, really, the world of architecture. So went through architecture school. I still was doing music. My college roommate was from Kentucky, and he turned me on to bluegrass. He had three cassette tapes, Best of Doc Watson, Best of Bill Monroe, and Best of Flatten Scruggs, and he played them over and over. And at first, it was a little abrasive. And then the more I listened to it, the more I thought, wow, there's something here. There's really something here. And then it almost got addictive in the sense that, okay, but the more I listened to it, the more I heard. It's like the more you learn about anything, the more you see. Okay. So I'm going to tuck that away because that comes back later. So graduated from architecture school, moved to Washington, D.C., was there for about 8 years, got a job with HOK. I interviewed over the East Coast between Washington and New York, and I got a few offers. I had worked a couple of years part-time before I graduated, and so I had a little bit of a portfolio of working drawings, which was to my advantage. And so I got a job at HOK in D.C. They designed the Air and Space Museum, the original one, but subsequently after I left, the new one out at Dulles. Was there for a while, got my license, and then went out on my own. My college roommate, Marty, came to join, and that's when I bought my first mandolin.
Were you still on the East Coast at that point?
In Washington, D.C., Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. Just, I mean, we could see the Capitol Dome from where we were. Where I lived and our office was right down the street. Could see the Capitol Dome right there. I had a running path from my house down Capitol Hill, and it really is a hill, down Capitol Hill to the Washington Monument, touch the monument, come back, go up the hill, and to my house was exactly 5 miles. So I would run that a good bit. I don't know if you can do that. I don't know if you can get on the Capitol grounds now to do that, but I just ran right across the Capitol grounds. And so we were doing small projects, renovations, and we're doing pretty good for a new firm. And he had his guitar, and we would take a break. He would play his guitar, and I said, well, I need an instrument so I can play music too. So we went and I got a mandolin, my first mandolin. And then we played together a fair amount and had music parties. And so that was a lot of fun. He wound up going back to Lexington, Kentucky. And then I moved back to Hattiesburg, Mississippi. That was one of those hometown calling kind of things. I would go back and visit the folks and drive down the main street and think, oh boy, I could do so much better than this. And as a young architect, it seemed very simple, but it wasn't quite that simple. But I did move back and I did built a lot of buildings there in Hattiesburg and had some nice projects there. And my firm grew pretty rapidly. And a few years in, not that many years in, I was up to 15 people in my firm.
Wow.
Three project architects and six draftsmen and a couple of administrative people.
Around what year is that?
The mid-90s, mid-90s. And over the course of the 90s, I designed probably over 1,000 buildings, but built 600, something like that. Maybe I may not have designed 1,000, but there were a couple of hundred that weren't built. But I was doing a lot of work. The problem was I burned out doing it. I mean, it was like every morning I would get up at 4 a.m., go straight into work, and then take a break at about, go home at 7, take a shower, be back in by 8 when everybody came in, and then be in meetings all day. And that was 6 or 7 days a week of, and then I would work well in the evening. I would work 12, sometimes 16 hours a day, every single day. And after a while, it just really started taking a toll on me. And then I I came to a point where I'd kind of leveled off at 10 people in the office. And I got this commission for the hospital I was born in. Still had the same delivery room and emergency room. Well, they were building a new wing on their hospital delivery and emergency room. So I had done a project, a design project for a doctor there, a really cool renovation of his house. And so he suggested to the hospital, hey, you know, get James Polk to do this. And they had had an architect there for the last 20 years that had been working on things. And the administrator said, okay, well, let's have them both do a scheme on it and they'll both do a plan and look at that and we'll award based on which plan we like. So it's kind of competition. So we did that, submitted a plan, and they called me and said, congratulations. You've got this job, biggest project to date that I got. And oh, this is great. You know, it's a big cash heavy project.
Life-changing.
Yeah, life-changing. So felt really good. Then I got a call a couple of days later and the administrator was just, I could tell by his voice something was going on. And they took the project to the board of supervisors and they said, okay, here's what we want to do. They put my plan up. Here's what we're going to do. Here's how we're going to pay for it. It was a county hospital, so they had to get signed up. Here's how we're going to pay for it. And James Polk is our architect. And the head of the board of supervisors, I had had a run-in a few years before that because I had designed this beautiful building for a regional landfill. And it was the administration building. And it was very barn-like structures, not expensive at all. At the time, it's like $85 a square foot. That was a long time ago. But still, it was very inexpensive. And the landfill had the city jurisdictions and the country jurisdictions. Well, the guys from the counties got into a big argument and they were pounding on the desk literally and said, we don't need no Taj Mahal. We need a metal building with no windows. And the guys from the mayors and the aldermen from the cities were going, well, wait a minute. You know, we're bringing school kids out here. We've got the board meetings out here. It's a beautiful building, but he says he can build it for that amount of money. And let's do it. So they voted on it and the city folks all voted yes. And there were five of them. And when it came for the country folks to vote, they didn't vote. They abstained. They wouldn't even put it on, but they were steam. Well, turned out the head of the board of supervisors was one of those guys. And he said, well, you can build what you want, but you can't use old James Polk as your architect. And he said, sorry, but you're out.
Oh, wow.
And we built that earlier building for exactly the amount of money, no change orders. And it's one of my best buildings. Yeah, it's one of my favorite buildings. And everybody that goes into that, the administrator told me about the landfill building. He says, everybody who comes in here comments on how beautiful this building is. All right. So that's what got me yanked from that job, me doing what I consider some of my best work. Well, you know, you can imagine the sense of unfairness of that. Well, a couple of other jobs just kind of fell through at the same time. I almost had a heart attack, literally. 39 years old, I almost had a heart attack. It was apparent that if I kept on doing what I was doing, I was going to have a heart attack. And so I went to the firm and said, okay, this is it. I'm closing it down. And I had, 50 active projects, maybe not then, maybe by then 30, because they were getting bigger.
So when was this? When did you close it down?
Late 90s, 99. So in 99, I said, that's it. I'm closing it up. You guys find jobs. And it took me a year to finish up the different projects. So totally changed my trajectory, totally unplanned. But I knew as a matter of survival, I couldn't do it anymore. So I got down to just me and finished my last job. And then literally the week after I finished my last job and didn't have anything to do, the wife of a friend called me from Minneapolis and said, hey, is this James Polk? The new Neil Daugherty, my husband? And yeah. I'd known him in college and then wasn't internet back then. So lost contact. He said, yeah, I know you haven't seen him for a while, but he still talks about you. And so I'm giving him a 40th birthday party. This is your life birthday party. Will you come up to Minneapolis and surprise him? And I said, well, for the first time in, I can't even remember, I've got time to do that. So sure. So I go up there, drop in on him. That was fantastic. And when I came back, I'd never been to Taliesin. So I got there and got on the last tour of the day. And as we were coming around the bend and Taliesin in the tour bus and Taliesin came into sight, it just overwhelmed me. I was fighting back tears. I didn't realize this was going to happen, but it was very emotional. And so we did the tour. And I said to myself, this would be a place for a sabbatical. And, I could maybe get a place here and go and get a job in Madison somewhere 40 miles away. I mean, everything fell into place. Once I decided, hey, I think I need to do this, everything fell into place. This house right across from Taliesin that I saw, I was talking to a guy at the gift shop who's become a good friend. And asked him where he lived. He lived in that house, that Gambrel house across the street from Taliesin. I said, oh, that's a really kind of a nice house. Well, I don't, it's got some problems. It's old and we're moving out next. I'm getting married and we're moving up to some other place. I said, okay, well, introduce me to the owner. And he did and went back to Mississippi, came back up to Wisconsin, had dinner with the owner who was James Dresser, a former Taliesin apprentice. And by the end of the dinner, I was in the house and he had hired me to do drafting for him. And I'm in the house. I'm looking at three Frank Lloyd Wright buildings from my front window. And that was the easiest thing I've ever done in my life. The last year of the architecture was the hardest thing I'd done in my life. But once I let go of that, it got really easy. And then all of a sudden I was there. And so I got to know people at Taliesin. And the entrance to that was Taliesin Chorus. They let me join the Taliesin Chorus. And so I sang with them and got to know people like Tom Casey, his wife Effie. And Tom was one of the main apprentices that did like Marin County. There's a story that I will tell at the Taliesin Experience about the Marin County Civic Center and the Magnificent Seven apprentices that did the drawings for that in a very short period of time. So one thing led to another. And in retrospect, I was very bold to go around showing the senior apprentices my portfolio. And of course, they, yeah. And also in retrospect, I probably would not have thought that they would do any other thing, but they must have thought something because they eventually asked me to come in as a visiting instructor and bring a project in. Students would go there and work on Frank Lloyd Wright's projects. And then after Wright died, they would work on Taliesin Associated Architects projects. And as those guys died off, they would invite other people in. I found this out afterwards that I was the first non Taliesin graduate that they brought in
wow.
for Learn by Doing. They bring people who worked on, and so they worked on my project.
Wow, what an honor.
Turned out to be the New American Village. It was a new community that I got a commission to do right after Katrina, a 67-acre development. So they worked on that, and we created in the class a New American Village principles of designing new cities anywhere. So we have some guiding principles that we developed, and also it was my design, but the students built this amazing model that shows really well and is still at Taliesin West. But toured the country, we toured that. We went to Denver to the ULI show. We did a symposium in Mississippi on the 1 year anniversary of Katrina to a packed house and a museum show of the model and a lot of my drawings and things. So that was really nice. And so after that, I moved back to Hattiesburg, and that's where I've been ever since. And I've had employees here and there, but I've kept it pretty small because after the Taliesin experience, I really wanted to go deep rather than wide. You know, there's an old expression, a mile wide and an inch deep. That's where I was in the 90s. I was trying to go deep. I was going as deep as I possibly could, but I was too wide to go deep. So I've kept it small, and I've been able to touch everything I've designed since then. And I really like that. And I feel like I know the buildings are better, but it's more fulfilling. And so I've done that for the last 20 years or so. And of course, the last few years, there's the Entree Architect overlay into that. And we can talk about that a little bit if you want. But
yeah,
basically, that brings us up to the current date. And I'm leaving out a few things, the modern day stuff, because I think we might talk about that here with the Taliesin experience.
Yeah. I know that music and architecture are still a major part of your life and your career and the work that you do. Tell me a little bit about how you brought music and architecture together.
You know, in retrospect, they've never been apart. Even when I wasn't consciously thinking about infusing architecture with music, I was doing it. I was giving a building a rhythm. I mean, I naturally went to rhythms in buildings and melodies and counter melodies and tone. Tone is another one. Tone, when everything is just resonant, it's just resonant. And that's my watchword is resonance. I want things to resonate, whether they're this or that, or I try to work with them until there's a resonance that you can feel. And when that happens, like in good music, art, architecture, if it resonates, you feel it before you see it. And that's what's meaningful to me. That's what I'm after, is having that resonant feel. And then you can look at the different articulations. But it's really that feel that I'm after, that resonant feel.
Yeah. So music, from the very beginning, has been a significant part of what you do as an architect. More recently, it's become very intentionally part of what you do.
Yes.
You've renamed your firm, literally, Music and Architecture.
Yeah.
What was the inspiration of that move from James Polk to Music and Architecture?
Well, you know, I think this is a good place to bring in Entree Architect, because one of the things I learned through just the supportive individuals, but also seminars and more consciously educational sort of things, is that authenticity is, there's a power in authenticity. For the early part of my career, yes, I was authentic by default, because, I mean, you put yourself into something whether you know it or not. But I was pretty generic in the sense that I was going after every project, every single project. Did I know how to do it? Well, no, but by the end of it, I might hopefully know how to do that. So I got a lot of experience, But then again, it was wide and it wasn't deep. And yes, I would go as deep as I could, but it was still more generic than I would have liked it to be. And so since I've been involved in Entree Architect, thinking about, well, branding, but we can get to that. The authenticity part. What can I do that nobody else can do? What can I bring to it that nobody else can bring to it? And that's what I started thinking about and listing my attributes, my strong points. You know, the natural thing in a career, I think, is to try to shore up the things you don't do well. And everybody needs to do that. I spent the first part of my career doing that. But after decades doing it, I feel enough competency in a lot of the I dotting and T crossing areas that I got really more interested in saying, what can I offer the world that's me that nobody else can get, and that's just me? And it's the music part. It's something I do naturally. It's something that the music came before the architecture. So it's something that I'm comfortable with, I'm comfortable talking about, I'm comfortable designing with it. And so now I work with musicians, I work with on music-related projects, performance-related, anything having to do with music. And also, I'm open to people who want to put musicality into their project, people who want that intentionality into a project. So I've gone from taking every single project to being very selective about the projects. And when it's just me and I don't have a payroll, then that's a lot easier. So easier said than done. If you've got a big firm, turning a big firm around is a pretty monumental thing. But I had the luxury of at least I have assistants and drafting people and consultants and things like that. But that's really where it was at, finding what I do that nobody else does. So when someone hires me, they hire me because it's me. They don't hire me because they want an architect who is in Mississippi, who's got a license there and this, that, and the other. They don't want a generic architect. And if they do, then I can send them to somebody. I can say, hey, you know, I'm not your person. So what happens though, there's a magic when that happens. There are far fewer projects, but the projects I do have, since I've shifted into music and architecture, and why are you going to hire me? And they have to tell me why they want to hire me personally. No one has ever negotiated a fee with me. I put the fee out there and that's it. The people accept the fee that I put out there. In the last 5 years, I've never negotiated a fee. And my proposals, I think I'm 100%.
Yeah. I mean, that's the power of niching down like that and focusing on one specific thing, your unique ability, right? The one thing that you do better than anyone else in the entire world.
Yeah.
And then go all in on it, right? So literally musicandarchitecture.com is your website, mm-hmm. right? So you've gone all in. That's it, right? So it's either architecture that has some sort of music focus, or the client has some sort of desire to incorporate music into their architecture.
That's right.
If it's not that, it's not you.
That's it.
Right. And if it is that, there's nobody else who does that.
Right. Exactly.
Let's take a quick break to say thank you to our sponsors for their support of this episode. This episode of Entree Architect Podcast is supported by WeCollabify, one of our trusted allied partners. As this community has grown over the years, one thing has become very clear to me. The partners we choose matter. Allied partners are not sponsors. They're not advertisers. They are organizations that we've taken the time to get to know, to work alongside, and to trust. They understand the real pressures of practice and the responsibility that comes with leading a small firm. WeCollabify earned that trust by helping small firm owners address a challenge that sits at the center of long-term firm health, building capacity in a way that supports people, not just projects. Their insourcing model brings skilled design, BIM, and technical professionals directly into your team. They work in your time zone
inside your systems and part of your day-to-day workflow. That integration allows firms to add capacity when it's needed, scale with intention, and grow without sacrificing culture, leadership focus, or quality of life. If you're thinking beyond short-term fixes and focused on building a firm that lasts, I encourage you, go learn why WeCollabify is one of our trusted allied partners. Visit WeCollabify.com/EntreeArchitect to learn more. That's WeCollabify.com/EntreeArchitect. Gain lessons learned and credits earned with Arcademy, ARCAT's continuing education program. Listen to popular episodes of the Detailed podcast and earn AIA-approved HSW credits. Yes, you heard that right, HSW credits for episodes of Detailed podcast. Listen to an episode, check out the learning objectives, and use what you've learned while listening to take the course. The program is free, it's simple, and can be found at arcat.com under the Resources tab. Or just go to arcat.com/arcademy. That's arcat.com/arcademy. That's arcat.com/arcademy. Please visit our sponsors today and thank them. Thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. So the clients who are interested in that only find one person. So therefore, your leverage with your fee becomes pretty much whatever is reasonably offered.
I'll add this, and this, because this may be helpful, is that on my questionnaire, on my entry questionnaire, if you press the Work with James tab,
yeah,
you go to this questionnaire that starts out with some dry stuff of just informational stuff. But then it gets more and more into what I'm offering and what. And the last question before you hit enter to send it to me starts out with, I'm paraphrasing here, but basically it's, knowing that I am probably your most expensive option, comma, why do you want me to work on this project? Something like that. But I preface it, knowing that I will probably be your most expensive option. And everybody who's gone in through there, and it hasn't been a lot, but every single person who's gone through there has become a client.
Fantastic. Yeah.
And has accepted my proposed fee without question.
Yeah. And you've spoken with me and you mentioned it a bit earlier that you credit the people in the community at Entree Architect with a lot of the inspiration and support and courage to do something like that.
Yeah. You know, support and encouragement, that's a big part of it. Because in a vacuum, saying that you're going to go from being open to every job to I'm only going to do one out of a million jobs or whatever, that's a pretty scary thing. But just being able to have these conversations with peers who are supportive. And, you know, the thing I love about Entree Architect is many times in the world of architecture, people are territorial. Architects are very territorial.
Yes.
And literally, you walk in their office and they'll cover up their title blocks, you know. And that's just not a healthy environment, I don't think. But Entree Architect, like on the Facebook page, if you post it on the Facebook page, hey, I've got this flashing detail that I'm scratching my head over, and this is what I've got so far. And you'll get 40 or 50 people saying, oh, you know, look at this product, or, oh, you've got this, you need to tuck this under there, or, oh, I did one just like this, and this is how I accomplished that, over and over, which is very refreshing to have a colleague in a world of competition, to have colleagues that are just out there to help you. I mean, it's very refreshing. And that goes, you know, that's the technical stuff, but also the, hey, I've got a client who I'm having a problem with and I don't know how to deal with this. And you'll get 40 people saying, oh, you know, I had a client like that and this is how we maneuvered. So there's information, but there's also support and encouragement. So I learned a lot about branding and a lot about focusing on the niche that is James Ray Paul. And as I moved forward and pressed forward and pushed away all these jobs.
Takes a lot of courage.
Pushed away all these jobs. And then the grass started growing and it got really green and lush. And not that there were a huge number of projects, but if it's just me, I don't need that many projects. I've got plenty of work. In fact, to do this tour that I'm planning, I've turned down a fair amount of work to just because of this, just because I'm opening space for this tour. I don't know if I'm going to accept another job this year.
Tell me about the tour. And last year you came to me and you said you were thinking about doing this tour and that you had this idea for an event to launch the tour from Taliesin, this place that is so special to you and so special to so many architects, that you wanted to bring architecture and music and this literally this music tour that you were about to launch and launch it from Taliesin, and you wanted the Entree Architect community to be part of that. Tell me the inspiration for that and how that came about.
So over the last few years, I've done a deep dive into the mandolin music of Bill Monroe, who was the father, considered an undisputed father of bluegrass music. He invented a genre of music, and that's pretty powerful for one individual to do. And interestingly enough, Bill Monroe, who's father of bluegrass, and Frank Lloyd Wright are totally opposite in many ways, but are very similar in many ways. They each had about a 70-year career. They both came out white hot as 20-year-olds and had a great early career, but kept reinventing themselves all the way through their career. Frank Lloyd Wright was designing new and even more modern buildings up until the day he died. Bill Monroe had a tune he wrote called Tromboline, which was bringing the trombone into bluegrass, which was, I mean, it was like Steve Jobs. I mean, he created the thing and then he was reinventing it, the thing after he created the thing, even though the thing he invented was fantastic.
Right.
He's still recreating that thing. And that was very inspirational. So I wrote a collection of music, instrumental music, based on the mandolin music of Bill Monroe and the architecture of Frank Lloyd Wright, using principles I've learned from Frank Lloyd Wright's architecture, designing the songs, designing the tunes. And so that collection of tunes I recorded with an amazing studio band. And now I'm about to release the album in June. And releasing it with a tour of iconic architectural sites, music in architecture, literally music in architecture. So the building becomes part of the acoustic. The building, because there are five in the band, the building is the sixth band member. So the building is part of the acoustics. And that'll be interesting, us playing to the acoustics of the hall, which Taliesin Hillside Theater, newly renovated, has some really great acoustics. And I've sung there many times in the chorus and gone to formals. And that's what the Taliesin experience is. It's the Taliesin formal. And when I say formal, not necessarily black tuxedos, but artistic formal. You do dress up a little bit and you have reception, cocktails, talk to people, tell stories, visit.
And this is something that Frank Lloyd Wright did.
Yes.
When he was practicing and living in Taliesin.
Exactly. And, you know, it's kind of out in the middle of nowhere, really, 40 miles from Madison. Spring Green is a town now of maybe 1,100 people and just farmland everywhere. So they would have their own culture and have formals where there would be a reception, then dinner. And the apprentices, this is interesting, the apprentices would serve the dinner at the School of Architecture. Would serve the dinner. They would set the tables, design the flower arrangements, design where the tables were. It was a design project to fit out the dining room for these formals. So you would have dinner, then you would walk over to the theater and either see a movie or hear a concert, or the choir would sing a few numbers. And that is the Taliesin formal. So you're there experiencing the music and the fellowship, but you're also touching the walls. You're touching the stone walls that framed history.
Right.
And for me, it's always profound. I mean, it never gets old going in Taliesin. And it's a feeling. It's just, I mean, I can feel it in my bones when I'm in there. I can feel it in my flesh. There's something so alive in those buildings that it's like a painting. You can't really see it when it's two-dimensional in a book. But when you're there, I mean, you can get a sense of it. But when you're there and you touch the walls and you touch the wood, it's visceral in the best way.
What does the Taliesin experience mean to you to have 90 of your peers travel to Spring Green, Wisconsin, to experience this event, go to this reception that Frank Lloyd Wright has done, right? So we're following in the footsteps of Frank Lloyd Wright and the Taliesin experience to have that reception, dinner, then walk over to the theater and the performance, the headliner is you. What does that feel like?
Well, it's a little surreal. It's a little surreal, but in another sense, it feels right. It just feels like it's meant to be. And putting this together was no small feat. And if anyone knows about any big organization, and especially on organizations that curate amazing architectural spaces, this has been a job, just putting, you know, this has been a commission. This is like the time I would spend on a design commission, I'm spending on putting this together, but it's all fallen together really well. And I think part of it is there are some people, there one or two people that are still there when I was there 20 years ago. So there are a few people there who remember me, and thankfully, fondly. So there was a little bit of an entree there, but it was the proposal of bringing music into architecture. And also, one of the reasons they brought me on is to teach, is that Tom Casey told me that I understood the principles that Frank Lloyd Wright was putting out there better than a lot of the people who went to school there. And for me, it had to do with study. It had to do with just feeling into it, feeling and understanding it on a intuitive level. So yeah, it's no small feat putting this together, but it feels natural. I'm really, really stoked to offer this to my friends and colleagues, because if they're a fraction as interested in Frank Lloyd Wright as I am, they're going to find it fascinating. And everyone is interested in design. And on that level, it will be in a piece of history.
Yeah.
So the setting will be amazing. And I've worked really hard to bring my skill level up to the level of everybody else in the band. I've got a great performance band. It's going to be good music. It's vibe music. It's instrumental. It's all instrumental. So when I went into this, I was told all of the musicians on it that it's a vibe recording. It's not about playing every note exactly the same every time. It's about feeling your way through it. Understand the idea. And this goes back to Frank Lloyd Wright and his design. Understand the idea. Understand the nature of the idea. And then everything, all the articulations in that and all the details in that tune reflect back to the nature. They spring from the nature of that tune, just like all of the design decisions in a Frank Lloyd Wright building would spring from the main idea of the building. So in that sense, the songs are analogous to how to put together a building, and each one's a facet. Each one shows that building from a different angle. So I told the musicians that we lock in on the melody, lock in on the idea of the tune, and then if it feels right, play that. Don't reach over here or reach over there to go get something to pull it in.
Right.
There doesn't need to be any ornament on this that's not springing from the idea of the tune. So I think people are going to enjoy it, and I'm really excited to have this come about.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. This event is a unique once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
It is.
This is not a reception that Taliesin does all the time and we're just plugging into it. This is an event that James has designed from the beginning to the end. It is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. This is the only time this will ever happen. And so if you are a member of this community, you should go to entrearchitect.com/Taliesin. Go check out the details. Learn how you can get tickets. It is limited to 90 people and tickets are already on sale. So grab your tickets now if you're interested in going. And this is a place that you want to go. This is an event that if you don't go, I think that you may be feeling it, right? I think you may be regretting it if you don't go and it's happening and you're not there. So entrearchitect.com/Taliesin to learn more. James Ray Polk is his name. Musicinarchitecture.com is his website. If you want to go check out what he's doing at his architecture firm and the inspiration, it's all there, musicinarchitecture.com. If you want to listen to some of James's music, James Ray Polk on Spotify, search for James Ray Polk. Don't just search for James Polk because that's a different musician. So James Ray Polk, you'll find James. On YouTube and TikTok, the Mississippi Sawyers, that's his band, is the Mississippi Sawyers with an S, Mississippi Sawyers. Make sure you search for Mississippi Sawyers on YouTube and TikTok, and you'll find that. We'll have links to all of this on the show notes for this episode and entrearchitect.com/Taliesin, June 8th.
June 8th, which is Frank Lloyd Wright's birthday, which makes it extra special.
Yes.
All you got to do is remember Frank Lloyd Wright's birthday.
Right, June 8th, 2026 at Taliesin. It is Frank Lloyd Wright's birthday, which makes it even more special.
Just a little history. The Frank Lloyd Wright birthday formal was always the biggest and most special of the year.
So here we go. It's amazing. EntreArchitect.com/Taliesin to learn more. James, thank you very much for the work that you do. The story that you just told is fascinating. The courage that it took to shut down a fully functioning, successful firm in order to shift your focus to new things is inspirational. And then you did it again with music and architecture. Total shift. Takes tremendous courage to do that. So thank you for telling that story to inspire others who may be feeling similar things. Thank you for bringing this amazing event to our community, because you could have just done this on your own and offered it to the world, but you brought it to us, to Entre Architect. And I thank you for that. This is going to be an amazing event for the people who attend. And thank you for coming by here and sharing your story and your knowledge at Entre Architect Podcast.
Amen. Thank you so much, Mark. Entre Architect has meant so much to me over the past few years, and it is in part the reason that I'm doing what I'm doing. So thank you for founding the organization and making it into a very vital force. And I'm just so happy to share my music with the members.
You're welcome, James. If you enjoyed this episode of Entre Architect Podcast, please share a link with a friend, because that's how we've continued to grow and serve thousands more small firm architects just like you. Thank you to our sponsors for this episode. Links to the sponsors and all the resources we discussed today, they are all available in the show notes for this episode at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Entre Architect is a proud member of the Gable Media Network. It's the multimedia network moving the architecture, engineering, and construction industries forward through the power of storytelling. You can earn AIA continuing education credits by listening to select episodes of this podcast and many others at gablemedia.com/members. And if you are a small firm architect, listen up. Join us today at Entre Architect Network. It's the worldwide community for entrepreneur architects. We've been around since 2012, and our basic level is now free to join. Yes, you can join Entre Architect Network for free, and that gives you access to valuable business resources and our global community of architects. And you can upgrade anytime for live coaching, AIA approved training, and mastermind support. So visit entrearchitect.com to learn more and to get started. My name is Mark R. LePage. Thank you for listening to the Entre Architect Podcast. Love, learn, share.
Are you NCARB certified yet? Join the network of over 45,000 architects who have the NCARB certificate to expand your professional reach. By becoming NCARB certified, you are demonstrating that you've met the national standards for licensure, a qualification that can be an important factor for firms when hiring and promoting. Certificate holders have a streamlined path to apply for a reciprocal license in all 55 U.S. jurisdictions, as well as access to an extensive library of free continuing education courses. Learn more today at ncarb.org.